From the Media Factory in the south end of Burlington, Vermont, this is 99.3 FM WBTV LP Burlington, streaming online at 99.3wbtv.org. This is Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers. I'm Shayla Connor Shapiro. Today on Write the Book, you'll hear an interview with Vermont author and poet Shanta Lee Gander about her collection Ghetto Claustrophobia, Dreamin' of Mama While Trying to Speak Woman in Woke Tongues, which won the 2021 Vermont Book Award for Poetry, is published by Diode Editions. Shanta Lee Gander is an artist who works in different mediums as a photographer, writer across genres, and is a public intellectual whose work has been widely featured. In addition to Ghetto Claustrophobia, she is the author of Black Metamorphosis, coming from Etruscan Press in 2023. What Shanta Lee describes as a 2,000-plus-year-old phone line open to Ovid, as well as an interrogation of the Greek mythos, while creating her own new language in this work. Shanta Lee is a writer for Art New England, Ms. Magazine blog, a Vermont Public producer and reporter, and teaches media studies at the Putney School. More information about the collection. So what does it mean to move away from the shadow of one's mother, parents, or family in order to come into being within this world? As collective memory within the Black diaspora has been ruptured, Ghetto Claustrophobia time travels by creating and recapturing memory from a fractured past to survive in the present and envision a future. In her first full-length collection, Ghetto Claustrophobia, Dreamin' of Mama While Trying to Speak Woman in Woke Tongues, Shanta Lee Gander navigates between formal and vernacular styles to introduce the reader to a myriad of subjects, such as scientific facts that link butterflies to female sexuality and vulnerability, whispers of classical Greek myth, H.P. Lovecraft's fantastical creature, Cthulhu, and the traces of African myth-making and telling. Beneath the intensity, longing, seeking, wondering, and the tell-it-like-it-is voice that sometimes tussles with sadness, there is a movement of sass and a will that refuses to say that it has been broken. Gander leaves a door ajar in this ongoing conversation of the Black female body that walks the spaces of the individual within a collective, the tensions between inherited and hidden narratives, and the present within a history and future that is still being imagined. My interview with Shanta Lee Gander begins with her reading the title poem of her collection. I hope you enjoy our conversation.
Ghetto Claustrophobia. Whether place, people, state of mind, you be locked in until you don't want to be. Now, people. Ghetto claustrophobics, also ghetto claustrophobes, ghetto claustrophobians. One, any group of people, they evade capture, they evade description. Two, identity, perceived or imagined. Noun, a place. Ghetto claustrophobia. One, fashioned for but not by, think characters, think prompts. Two, big, so big, expansive, endless. Three, any place, the place with the matching riding mowers, that place where cliques of moms go by the same name. Four, hotel room, apartment, house, dreamscape, cityscape, rulescape, selfscape, could be another country, could be the human body as container, as shell, as place, from block to brick to burb to brownstone to any place, as in so many, as in endless. Five, these places, real and imagined, just like the people, they evade capture. Adjective, state of mind, states of being. Only an ailment if you want it to be. One, Black girlhood in America. Two, nightmares. Three, stages of human development.
Thank you for reading that. I thought that was such a great poem to open this collection with. It establishes the voice and experience of the entire collection really well, I think. And I think it has to do with language, but also the themes that are going to appear throughout your collection. I love that note, only an ailment if you want it to be, which to me doesn't discount any pain, but speaks to strength and speaks a little bit, I think, to agency.
It's funny because Every time I look at that line or think about it, I think it's funny. So I just did this talk to a group of students up north, and someone pointed out, I had left them with some thoughts, and it was along those lines, almost in capturing only an ailment if you want it to be. It's, you know, it's all about choose your community and tend to your garden, weed it, you know, people who aren't for you, weed it constantly, et cetera, et cetera. And one student pointed out, he said, okay, like, these are all things that have a theme of strength and X, Y, Z. And he basically asked the question, well, what about navigating the heart? And it was something that was just like, you know, when I look at that line, I don't regret putting it there, but I think, wow, of course, that's so me to say, you know, regardless, I want to be seen as almost unbreakable, even though that couldn't be farther from the truth with all the fissures and shatters and pieces gone missing. And so it's reclamation. And also I want to say it's okay if it is an ailment.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes ailments we can't help that we have an ailment sometimes, and we should tend to that and be compassionate towards that.
Right. Yeah. I love that line. I think that's great. The other line I really loved, this is a great poem, but places that evade capture.
Yes.
And later, some of the poems allude to place and to lost place. You have a poem at the end that we're not going to read, which is too bad because I loved it, but it's a little long, but it's called Curatorial Tags for the Exhibition. And you allude to Harold Street circa 1988 and the first time I learned houses like people go missing. And that reminded me of places that evade capture and just sort of the existence of place in this collection. I wonder if you can just maybe talk a little bit about place in your poetry and how important that is.
Absolutely. And I've thought about it extensively, too, in prose. Sometimes on my SoundCloud, I'll put up, I've been trying to resurrect it. And I did like a short series on place and whether or not, you know, are they in and of themselves something that harm people, or is it the harms that happen upon the soil that then carries that energy?
Mm-hmm.
And there's something about memory that, at least for me, has made me feel part excavator, part thief, you know, part like I'm like breaking in to go like explore and see what's there. Specifically to where I mostly spent most of my time growing up, 280 Collins Street, it has felt like it's abandoned now. It's been shut down, abandoned, et cetera. There was a fire. They've never reopened it.
Where was that?
Oh, in Hartford, Connecticut.
Okay.
And so I went, I don't remember how this quite happened, but I went by and I said, oh my God, it's abandoned. And I love breaking into abandoned places. And I'm like, well, this is the irony of trying to break back in the very place I wanted to break out of. And I feel that memory can be like that too, because there can be moments in our lives or situations or even places where we ache and long to leave them for another place. But then even when we leave, we find ourselves saying, oh, wow, I want to break back into that other place.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's this house near us. It's this old brick house that's for years been just falling in on itself. It's in Charlotte, Vermont. And my husband and I will bike past it and say, what's the story with that house? Like, it's falling apart, like literally, as brick by brick, as the years have gone by. And the other day we were riding by and there was actually like big front loader, like pulling down the house. So we stopped and we wanted to go in. We kind of like approached the house and we got like thrown off the property by somebody. I don't know. It was too bad because I was like, I felt like I've been watching that house for so long. It felt like a part of me, you know. But anyway, that's not what you're talking about. So sorry.
No, but it is kind of similar in that there are things, the psyche can be like that, where even within our own psyche and in our own selves, there may be spaces that are so abandoned and falling in on itself and collapsing. And it's not until something happens, right? Mm-hmm. Like whether it's a degeneration or people are around you trying to tell you and remind you of that place, or you yourself might want to try to go visit it and you may not be curious until something prompts you to actually go in.
Right. Yeah. You were talking about excavating memory, and it reminded me of a question I have for you that I was going to ask later, but I'm going to ask it now. Do you think that writing about your life or doing photography that is in some way informed by your experience, does that change your experience? Does that change your memories?
Oh, that's a really good question. It's almost like you get to shape shift them in some ways. Like there's a way that, no, obviously in journalism, it's like, obviously you're seeking the truth. Mm-hmm. There's no embellishing. Mm-hmm. And you can use the skill of writing to tell the story and have it be a narrative and have a narrative arc, but you're not going to embellish it. You know, the whole goal is to make sure that there's clean space for the truth or for someone to say their truth or their piece. In these areas, I do feel like for poetry, for prose, and even photography, it gives me an opportunity. Well, I want to actually borrow from something that I heard about the creator from PBS America Outdoors, who said, he said outdoors is returning to the scene of the outdoors is the scene of the crime, because he was talking about that in relation to Black and brown bodies. In some ways, I like to return to the scene of the crime, I guess you could say. Mm. And that gives me, and in some cases, depending on what it is, I do get to move around the furniture and play with that and do something maybe imaginative, as long as I'm letting the reader know what it is, especially if it's nonfiction.
Uh-huh.
If it's in the area of going towards quasi-fiction, nonfiction, hybridity, there's more play there. And there's definitely a realm of play with poetry.
Yeah, absolutely. It's fun because sometimes I can almost feel a story in your poem. Sometimes I feel a real story. I can almost follow it like I am there. And then there'll be something that I'm like, I'm not there. You know, like this is, and not that I'm not getting something from it, but that this is somebody else's story. Anyway, we'll get to that. Yeah. I have a question about that later. Would you mind reading Dreaming of Mama on page 22?
Oh, absolutely. Dreaming of Mama. Here. Mama be like, I'ma carry your bag, sharing the burden she's put in it. Here, we argue like sisters, screaming the trauma that created us. We show up, lulled into forgetting, starting where we ended to do it all again. If I arrive awake, she shows me how to read the witness marks, saying, our bodies, the clocks. Our mamas multiplied by greatness. They be horologists.
Thank you. I love that. The mention of horologists in extending the metaphor of the clocks is just wonderful. And I think there's another poem that talks about the horologist later too. Yeah. So now you write creative nonfiction and you write poetry. Is your creative nonfiction memoir or?
This book, this first collection is more personal and maybe biopic than Black Metamorphosis, which comes out next year.
And that's, is that essays?
It's a book of poetry.
Poetry.
Poetry, yeah. I would say I am working on a memoir-esque project that goes into the deeper story that you could say these poems give hints at, but the way I've arranged it, I've tried to arrange it so that the self is within the bigger form of history. Mm-hmm. So that it's this telling on multiple levels.
Oh, wow.
And, but I also write, my prose is a range. I've written about some of, you know, some deeper thoughts about, let's say, what I've been taught about space and minding myself in space. I've written about creative things. I started a journal right at the start of the pandemic, actually, just kind of bringing together it. Most likely, I think it's going to be a book of essays. I'm still shaping it, bringing together pop culture and references and like a reflecting back mm-hmm. of what I was seeing, experiencing, et cetera. We'll see how that shapes. So my prose is really quite a range. I like to do hybridity in terms of thinking about lyricism and rhythm and meter like you would with poetry mm-hmm. and bring it to the lines of prose. So, yeah, there is a memoir on the horizon.
Okay, that's cool.
Or I'll say memoir-esque because of the way that I'm approaching it.
Now, let's talk about the structure of this particular collection.
Yes.
You have four sections. Mm-hmm. And in the middle of the four sections, there's an interlude called The Day God's Thermostat Broke, Ghetto Claustrophobic yes. Dream Interlude. I love that. so I wonder if you can talk about coming up with this structure and how you might mm-hmm. describe the movement from beginning to end to someone who hasn't read your collection.
That is a really good question. So originally, I had chopped this up for each of these to either they were going to be separate chapbooks or so Ghetto Claustrophobic Dream Interlude. I think it predated all of this, actually, or most of it. I mean, some of these poems are older and they were revisited and reshaped. Mm-hmm. And so it moves from, so I belly dance, have belly dance intermittently. And I think of the page as a stage where you think about what's moving in the body through the eye and through voice. And I'm not always thinking of that when I just sit down and write. I'm just trying to get it out and sit down and write. I wanted to move from some concrete things in sections one and two where I'm talking about family and really introducing the, you know, narrator's relationship, especially with mother or different levels of mother. And then getting into the self, you know, so we're moving from mother to self. So some individuation and kind of where you get to see the narrator thinking in space and looking at and exploring the self almost maybe within the shadow of mother or maybe separate from mother. But then after those explorations, I felt, okay, there needs to be some break where it, you know, the formatting is different. It is prose poetry in that middle section. It becomes something where the reader kind of gets a break where they're not sure if they're quite awake or asleep or in between as they're witness or immersed in. And then on the other side of this is still a narrator trying to make some sense. I mean, at least that's my understanding, because when I was putting this together, I wasn't necessarily thinking about the shape yet. It was mm-hmm. just more like, oh, I guess this is going to be a book. And just a short story of how it started. It came out of celebrating Frankenstein, the 200th anniversary of Frankenstein.
Yeah.
And doing a write-in in the same spirit that Frankenstein was created, you know, the dare to create something
that's
scary.
Right. It was done like at a house party, right?
Yeah. Lord Byron
right.
and Percy and Mary Shelley. And they had a couple of other people there too. And it was issued as a dare. And so me and a group of people dared each other and sort of like, you know, we pulled pieces of that. We read Rossetti's, you know, Goblin Market and things like that. What I was shocked by is what came out in the form of poetry, because usually these kinds of memories I would explore through prose. And I was, my poetry was separate from putting 280 Collins Street in my poetry.
Okay.
But it showed up in my poetry. And I said, well, this is not really monstrous. Or I said, wait a minute, maybe it is. Maybe it is. Yeah. Maybe this is the horror. Maybe this is what came out of this, what I'm exploring.
That's interesting. I felt like there was almost a kind of fable-like quality to some of these poems. And it was like, you know, there's language like fairies in the woods and fairy dust. There's myths that include the Minotaur, for example, later in the collection. There's one, oh no, you know what? I'm going to wait because that's one that you're going to read. Would you mind? Let's do this. Why don't we go out of order a little bit? Could you read Speaking of Crazy?
Yes, I'll do that.
Thank you.
Okay. And this is out of the Day God's Thermostat Broke Ghetto Claustrophobic Dream Interlude. Speaking of crazy, sometimes boredom has a way about it. A kind of saunter like its twin trouble. They both show up when it's hot. See, trudging through snow or trying not to fall on ice don't work well for these two. Trouble and boredom manifested in a dude, the color of one of the early spring flowers, color of forsythia. No government name, but a one-word, two-syllable street name. He was straight out of the Newport Pleasure ad, a cat with a slick look. What he bloomed, we didn't want. And like forsythia, he appeared on time and within his season. He made us pay attention to the way that day ate night, the way night ate children who had to succumb to the endless ride in the purple Cadillac. He made us pay attention to what happened when mamas felt the heat of a broken thermostat when their husbands are at work, the ghetto version of a bar hop. He taught us that people like houses are interchangeable. He taught us that like the endless tap in a bar hop, intoxicated cars stumble like the ones that had too many hunch punches. And when cars stumble in the heat, they hit telephone poles.
Thank you for reading that. I feel like that is a poem that fits what I was saying a minute ago about the almost fable-like quality. Both because it's got some pretty dark material sometimes, and yet there's like a play of language happening. There's day eating night. There's night eating children. You know, really interesting to me.
I love fairy tale, myth, legend, and it's funny because I didn't realize. I was like, oh, there's a Minotaur mentioned here too. Funny, because there's a Minotaur coming up in the next collection too. And there's something about, you know, I'm a big horror fan, and you know, there's something about hoping and wanting the myth and fairy tale and tales to soak into my bones. I wanted to be a sponge so that when I sit down, that maybe I too could be creating and spinning something that feels akin to speaking a magic. At least that's my hope. That's my hope.
Yeah, well, it's great. Let's see. Now, and like with the poem that has a Minotaur in it, I'm not going to have you read that today. So sometimes I'm going to bring up stuff that we're not actually visiting. But so here's another example of stuff we're going to talk about we're not sharing the poem. But I want to talk about repeating words and phrases in multiple poems, sometimes poems that lead one into the other. So, for example, you have a poem called Forgotten Tastes Like Cheese Sour to the Tongue While Visiting Mother. And the words, there are the words mama's, 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 mama in that poem. And then you have the next poem, Mother Who Brung Ya, 3, Some Say. And that also uses the words mama's, 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 mama, which to me brings those two poems together in a way that maybe they wouldn't otherwise have been, which is really fun. So I'm wondering if you could just talk about how this echo of words might strengthen the collection as a whole, as it all fits together, if that makes sense.
It feels like a way of, you know, like in prose or a novel, like you're reintroducing a color or you're reintroducing a character. And this is my way of kind of, also, you know, it's funny, I'm saying this for the first time, well, maybe not for the first time, but out loud, is trying to touch my ancestry. And it's almost like it's fuzzy. I'm not really sure about who exactly my great, 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 great grandmother was. And so trying to, like, a part of this even in the excavating, has been about trying to get at the family history and the family lore that makes up me, right? And even in the forgotten poem, The Forgotten Taste, like it, that poem, there's something about it where, you know, I'm talking a bit about the ritual of trying to get to a dead woman, you know, an ancestor, forgotten taste, like cheese sour to the tongue while visiting mother, you know, almost going through whatever world she's in, the other world, and trying to navigate and trying to talk to her, and then finding out, well, maybe I shouldn't be disturbing the dead like that. You know, maybe the ancestors don't want to be disturbed. Stop knocking on that door. Mm-hmm. You know, stop trying to talk to dead people. So there's a way the echo acted like, something akin to maybe a dowsing rod, something akin to the way that you might repeat or use words in a spell to cast.
Oh, sure. Like an incantation.
Like incantation. It was something of incantation, and it was something of trying to cast. And I figure if you can just repeat it and cast it, maybe that would open a space for an invitation.
Mm-hmm.
But you got to also be careful about what you're inviting to.
Right. It's funny. You thank your ancestors in the acknowledgments. I liked that too. That was cool. Let's see. Shanta, would you mind reading Learning Language?
Absolutely. And this was something directly influenced as I was thinking about Frankenstein. There's a scene in the book where he's observing a family. And that made me think of just the way sometimes in social media and other places that we're becoming almost like Frankenstein and observing what's going on in life that may be in a life that may be foreign to us and maybe in even our own lives. So learning language. One, symbols and sounds. We mimicked what we knew. We watched what we couldn't understand. It wasn't a bang, but the sound. It wasn't the expansion, but the capacity. Two, the Phoenician alphabet. Tables and kitchens keep count. How long does it take to commit 26 of them to memory? Celeste instead of mom for the corner store, for the way it had everything. Everything meant home. The way blue was gifted by autism, gifting the synesthesia we wanted. Three, Gutenberg in the locker. Your writing never looked like that. Secrets never seemed so loud. Spiral-bound notebooks hid in closets with birth control, Onyx, and Wu-Tang Clan. I was going to hide in her basement. We had the plan worked out. How many things can you fit into a locker? The things whose secrets take up no space. Four, write it, it will come. The street lamps across the way create what mouths refuse to birth. What do you want when you grow up? Freedom, love, money. There was a fourth and fifth forgotten to a curfew and to time. Five, 140 characters. Food can substitute feelings. Cats, dogs make you forget. See family photos. Father, mother, Dick, Puff, sometimes Sally. See my family. Six, symbols. We read shadows on screens, not seeing the tea leaves. We are the oracles of the new hieroglyphs, most fluent in six emoticons. Aumumawa wasn't looking for us. It was the cave drawing we sent back to ourselves. We were warned about the dangers of knowing ourselves too well.
I love that you mentioned before reading that what you were thinking of as, I mean, I totally took something else from it when you read it this time. I love that poem.
I wanted to talk about the vitality in details, which is important in all of your poetry. Mm-hmm. But it just jumped out, like the line, spiral-bound notebooks hid in closets with birth control, Onyx, and Wu-Tang Clan. And mm-hmm. it's funny because it's the specificity of objects, but it's also putting things next to each other that don't seem like they go. Because it makes your reader go, wait, what? And then read it again, which I love. So that's really fun. And then the other line that I really loved and is perfect for writers is write it, it will come, which is such great advice for writers.
Yes.
I don't know. I thought maybe that would be something that could lead us to talk about your own writing process if now is a good
Absolutely.
Time for that. Yeah. How do you work? Yeah. How do you approach it?
Well, so I know there's this wisdom of like sit down at the desk every day, you know, or I know people who get up at like 4 a.m. I can't do that. That is not me. I write inside my body. So there are things that are happening, especially if I'm doing a lot of driving. Mm-hmm. I like to have my phone ready so I can just hit, okay, not using the phone while driving, everyone, but to hit record if there's a thought or I want to just start speaking. One of the very interesting exercises I just underwent, I had hand surgery at the end of May. And so I couldn't, I was like, literally, I just got permission to start typing last week mm-hmm. with both hands. Like mm-hmm. I couldn't do anything. I didn't feel like writing because it felt like a piece. I was like, what is going on with this other part of my body? So I started to practice some orality and kept an audio diary as I was like, you know, laid up and, you know, talking about the process and stories or whatever. And so my process, I love beautiful space for setting. I like to create a space to be ready for the writing. Sometimes that's not always the case. Right. Especially if I'm in a car and I'm like, okay, let me hit record and just say this out loud. Sometimes it looks like I like to carry a notebook around with me. Mm-hmm. I always have a notebook of some sort with me. Even this is going to sound funny. Here's another suggestion for people, a shenanigans list. And I'm going to tell you what the shenanigans list is. It is ridiculous quotes, things that friends have said. I don't put anyone's name next to it because if anyone finds it, I don't want people to think we're awesome, you know, or horrible set of human beings. But, you know, quotes, they're like stories. They're, you know, when my best friend and I went on a road trip recently to her daughter's graduation, with all these things, you know, writing down things that people had said or things we saw or things we experienced. And they're these little snapshots. So I carry a notebook and that shenanigans list might be used, especially it's just fun to revisit it because it's hilarious. It's a good laugh. But all of these like build up for like some kind of material. Also, my other tactic that I've used. So let's see. Several years ago, there was something, my memoir actually bloomed out of, I never saw myself as a straight prose writer. I started writing through a journal, keeping a journal when I was very young. I still have all my journals and poetry also was a first language for me. Suzanne Kingsbury, who's, you know, author, writer, like does so many things. She was holding her salon in the dollhouse years ago. And I remember there was this prompt about child's voice or memory. And from that, I wrote about the alleged black eye that my mother said I came, like my first day at kindergarten, I come home, kindergarten. And she says, she accused me of having a black eye. I'm like, I don't know what she's talking about. I can't see the mirror. So I wrote this chapter just based on from the six-year-old's point of view, from me, 6, 7 years old, wrote it from that perspective. And someone had said something that sparked what I'm about to tell you that I did next, that said, wow, your memory, the vivid details, you should make sure you make notes of all of that because as time goes on, memory starts to shift and reposition, right? So I made a lifetime line. I started a lifetime line. I dumped all the teachers I remembered from K through 12, all these incidents from basically birth to now. And then what I did along the timeline was plot out or some key moments, what happened, when it happened, so that when I was at VCFA and enrolled and working on my chapters, I was able to go to this timeline. And I'm like, oh, wow. I think, and then there are other things as memory comes and blooms, plugging in. So it's been very interesting that way. Yeah. And I find that life timeline is helpful. If anyone hasn't done it, do it. Just even if you're not planning on writing a book, just do it as an exercise. It's very fascinating.
Do you have it like in your computer, in a notebook? Is it covering a whole wall in your house?
Oh God, I would. Okay. If it were covering a wall, I don't think I'd want to go in that room. And it's funny because at some point I like alchemical art. I love things that are designed in certain ways. I could envision one day maybe taking some of the themes and doing a visual design, but for now it's just in a computer. There are different iterations of it. And it's this scrawling thing of this linear, you know, and this date, this happened, this date, this happened. And then some bullet points underneath some key things and snapshots that I remember.
Let's see. So, speaking of your life timeline and your life, your life timeline and my life timeline intersected a tiny bit over Michael Jackson. I wonder if you would read the poem Surviving R. Kelly and Michael Jackson when they are your childhood soundtrack.
Absolutely. Surviving R. Kelly and Michael Jackson when they are your childhood soundtrack. One. Sundays belong to Mahalia, but by Monday, Monday was Millie Jackson's day. By Friday, mamas didn't know it yet, losing one sense to gain another, the ability to insert themselves in between the breath and space of each lyric that left his lips. There was no doubt he was saying about them. He was singing to them. Two, he was singing to us, reminded us they didn't care about us. How could we question that? How could we break the big he became, giving original meaning to the blurred lines we were never going to question? The same way we could never question this truth. We never stopped looking for how to get back. We figured if we can make mortals into heroes and heroes into gods, then there'd be no question. We were all in that image of the holy, right? Three, we can't question the holy created by our own hand, no more than we can question the magician who made age slip into numbers, slip in and out of mouths of grown women as their daughters went missing. Lyrics became the psalms we repeated as we became accomplices to our bodies becoming ignitions, cars, jeeps, or an endless hotel. He birthed relationships into existence, spoke babies into being. How do we question he who made us sanctified on the dance floor? Four, on the dance floor is where I would try to shuffle left, shuffle right, buck my hips. If I buck my hips hard enough, I became him. The beat and his voice take me back to that world premiere. The way he reinvented the thing we can't name. How would we ever find anything vulgar in that? Five. Vulgar might not come close. It was proof turned pornography. Black girl interrupted by viewing parties, by all the women who said they would have taken her place. How many different ways did we all claim it wasn't him? Six. Did they do it? That is not really the question. How did the music make us feel at our weddings, graduations, all those Saturday nights at the club? Didn't they remind us of flying with our feet on the ground? Did they do it? When our stories went missing, didn't we say they were the ones who handed them back to us? Where do I put the cassette tapes, the albums, the... Can we unpaint all the pain that's been on the walls in the rooms of our psyche? Can we remove all the wallpaper from our childhoods? Where is the sin in the gods created and crafted by human hands? As gods go, they demand sacrifice. What does sacrifice to a God look like? Our daughters, our sons, ourselves?
Thank you. I was so glad to read this poem because it's just hard to know what to do with feelings that we have, you know, particularly with celebrities, because, you know, you don't know them. You feel like they're your best friends and they're your gods, but you don't know them. So this felt like a very important poem and just a wonderful way to think about things from all different sides. I love how you manage abandonment and condemnation and joy and disgust. It's all in there, kind of. And it's funny because it also reminded me, it was almost like another place that can disappear. You know what we were talking about at the beginning, right?
Yes. Well, and it's also this way of like, what do we do when we find out some information? Like, okay, Dr. Seuss. Racist, misogynist, not a good husband, the whole gamut. Dr. Seuss, I would credit those books to the introduction to play with language. Mm-hmm. You know, I had a little Dr. Seuss set, you know, I plan on re-engaging with it just because I remember it from my childhood. But what do? Do you go back and say, that's so toxic, I don't want anything to do with Dr. Seuss? Or do you say, no, I'm going to actually engage with this aspect because that's a very complex person and the rest of him can go over here. You would say the same of Picasso, like, you know, all these different people who contributed to culture and to art and humanities in so many different ways. You can't just go, in my opinion, now other people might say something different, especially as we think about cancel culture. But for me, it would be all too easy to say, I'm shutting that out. What's not easy is sitting with it and saying, well, what do I want to take away knowing what I know? But maybe there is something good here out of this wreckage. Maybe. Salvageable. Salvageable.
I think, too, it maybe has something to do with the art form, right? So, like, can we find the old Bill Cosby? You know, can we find his old stuff funny anymore?
You know, that's interesting.
I don't know. I think it's harder to do funny than it is to do beautiful or to do poignant. I don't know. Like Joan Rivers. I remember when Joan Rivers' husband committed suicide, I was like, can she ever be funny again? That would be so hard. How can you be funny? That's a little different. But anyway, sorry.
No. That actually raises a good point, though. I actually was talking to someone a few years ago, and they said, oh yeah, what a shame. I can't let my children watch the Bill Cosby show now. And I'm like, I didn't get into it with them. And I thought, no, that is not it. You know, I guess maybe I have a really twisted sense of things because I grew up watching the reruns of Dukes of Hazzard. My mother,
oh, wow,
had a crush. It was before my time, but she had a crush on the guys in the show. We all know General Lee was the car.
Right.
I think the car received more fan mail than anybody. And what was on top of General Lee? It was the Confederate flag. No one talked to me about that. I was rooting for that car to get away from the sheriff. And, you know, redneck culture. There's a celebration of redneck culture, country rural culture. I looked at it as a good time. I still think of that show fondly. Now, that's not to say that I condone the imagery. I'm just saying that I wonder about how can we, you know, instead of for myself, I don't have children, but so who the hell am I? But like, is it banning the Cosby show or is it? Well, no, go back. You get to now go back and see it through a different lens and then think about the complexity of him as a person. That is such an interesting area. Not great what he did at all. Horrible.
Right.
But how do we think about the complexity of the human person, like the complexity of ourselves as we go out even into the world?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's interesting. It's conflating art and the artist.
Yes.
Let's read a new poem. Could you read It Was the Night We Knew?
Yes. And again, this is from the interlude section, The Day God's Thermostat Broke. Ghetto Claustrophobic Dreaming Interlude. It was the night we knew Mother Nature threw her hands up. Mother Nature knew a good roast would teach all of our asses a lesson. Night was not for solace, but for good trouble. We parked the car near the bushes. We ignored the large orange signs, keep out, danger, closed for construction. We figured they didn't mean it. The dirt road was still ours. That dirt road, that cornfield, us making no apologies for getting out of the car and sauntering beyond the keep out signs as if they were meant for someone else. Us walking past the cornfield as if those big machines were warnings for someone else. Our bodies enveloped by darkness, shattered by huge headlights. They were coming for us. We got it now. We learned our lesson. We understood now and turned around. The ground became our drums as we beat it with our feet. Hot summer air ate our laughter, the last laugh had by the ditch that took one of us down. That's all how Wade happened. Picking him up on the side of the road, the idea about going into the woods and taking off our clothes. No one was looking. And when God's thermostat is broken, all of the irrational has a reason for existing. We sat around the fire holding ourselves and telling stories. We sat around the fire, none of us looking into Wade's eyes that night. As he spoke, the fire seemed to bring out the nameless color of his eyes.
That's the poem I was talking about earlier when I said, sometimes I feel like I'm right there in the story. And then at the end, I'm like, no, this is somebody else's story that I've gotten to kind of be a little bit of a voyeur and look in on this story for a minute. But I enjoy reading the stories in your poems. I like being able to look in on somebody else's life. I know that sounds a little harsh.
No, there's actually a whole, someone wrote, they must live in Manhattan. I don't know. They live somewhere in New York. They got away with it. Where they wrote this whole piece about being able to look into their neighbor's window, like these giant windows and watching their ritual, and wrote the piece. It was in the New York Times some years ago. And I thought, gosh, well, this has to have been a white woman to be able to get away with that.
Yeah.
I don't know if the person was another color or a different gender. Would they have been able to look through windows? Would they even have written a piece that they did such a thing?
That is actually a real entitled thing to do, right? To actually write about what, we're running out of time, and I really want you to be able to read one more poem. So I'm sorry I'm rushing us past this one.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Can you read Trying to Speak Woman?
Absolutely. Trying to speak woman, because I be bride, sometimes I be taken. My hunger produces lost friends, apartments. Their hunger expands into labyrinths. I am rebirthed by first lust and jealousy. Here I be a xenophobe, estranged from, adapting to their custom, their language, my body as wonderland, as kept, as what happens to me while I've gone missing. Me is their minotaur, an exotic of their imagining. The children of lack and plenty have nothing on me.
Thank you. Another one I just loved. The line, what happens to me when I've gone missing? Just these wonderful, subtle references that bring the poem to a different place. So the subtitle of your book, Ghetto Claustrophobia, is Dreaming of Mama While Trying to Speak Woman in Woke Tongues. And this poem is Trying to Speak Woman. And speaking woman is a theme throughout the collection. So I thought maybe I would ask you, what does it mean to you to speak woman?
Ooh, here's where I may get in trouble. Okay. I'm going to preface and just say, this is what my imagining is. What I wanted to be as a woman. So my mother wasn't, there's a line I have somewhere that she just wasn't the ambassador for a lot of things. She thought fingernail polish and different things were gateways to sex and being fast and all that. So that was not allowed. Wasn't taught how to put on makeup. And also her fashion sense was a bit interesting, let's say. So I wanted everything from garter belts to lace to someone could, and I know someone could read this and say, well, that's for male gaze. No, it's for me. It's the stuff that I didn't necessarily have access to, that I wanted to be able to just enjoy, like just enjoy. And also taking it out of that sense of the self-creation. Speaking woman means being able to navigate the world. If I have to, how can I get myself to safety if I must? How can I be witty? How can I shapeshift? If someone is trying to play me like a vinyl, how do I make sure to bust out their eardrums with my voice and with my will? So it's everything to do with an aesthetic for me and also a sense of a spirit for me. And that's just my definition of woman, not for anyone else's gaze, not for anyone else's enjoyment. And I say that because I'm someone also who enjoys corsets. I love them. Again, my own enjoyment for how I always wanted to envision myself since I was a little girl, who I was going to be as a woman, as an adult.
Here I am putting words in your mouth again, but it sounds a little bit like you're saying, you know, I want the choice. I want to choose who I will be.
Yes.
And however that looks is fine because it's my choice, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes, exactly.
There's this author photo at the back when you talked about the things you enjoyed wearing. This picture is so awesome. I'm not sure what you're wearing. You've got these pearls. And is that...
I can tell you the rest of the outfit.
Yeah, tell me.
It was a vintage opera jacket.
Okay.
And there's a dress. It's a lacy. It looks like, and it's got like a fabric paneling underneath, but there's like lace on top and it stops at the knee. And it looks like it's kind of vintage, but it's a lot of fun. And that's like the whole outfit. The rest of the outfit looks like that with this opera jacket, this full length opera jacket that goes down to the floor and some high heeled shoes.
It's a great shot. It's also wonderful of your face. You have this expression that is, how would I put this? Approachable, but also a little bit tired. I don't mean I don't mean tired like I want to go to sleep, but a little bit.
No, you're like fed up. Like,
yes.
Like, well, it's funny because I have this saying I say to friends, you know, I was not like a lot of us, depending on what you subscribe to, whether or not spirits are invited and manifest as children, whatever, not whatever, but some people believe that. Well, so I feel I wasn't invited to this, or I didn't know quite what kind of train ride I was coming to. Let's just put it that way. But while I'm on this train ride of life, damn it, I want to have fun. But yeah, there are sometimes along the way of walking the train cars, where it does get exhausting.
Yeah.
And it's sort of like, what? Are we there yet? Really? It's like, oh, there's more of this. No.
Yeah.
You know, you get stuck in the dinner cart or the sleeper cart. And that's my one of my metaphors.
Mm-hmm. It's apt. I do just want to mention you have an exhibit up now at the Fleming Museum of Art in Burlington, and it's called Dark Goddess, an Exploration of the Sacred Feminine. You're also a journalist, an award-winning photojournalist. I mean, we've just... I think seen the tip of the iceberg this morning on what you've got out there in the world. But I wanted to just ask you one last question. I always like to ask a question of advice for writers. And your bio at the end of the book describes you as an artist and multifaceted professional. professional. Mm-hmm. I wonder if you have advice for artists who want to express themselves in multiple forms, as you do, not necessarily one genre, not even just through writing, but all different ways.
Build the plane as you fly it, and do not let anyone tell you. There's everyone likes to say, I actually had someone I was working for once say to me, yeah, play to your strengths. No, do not play to your strengths. Do not play small, stay small. Don't do that. And don't worry about, well, I don't know, like filmmaking. I took a foray into filmmaking with this exhibition, used it as an opportunity to do something. And I didn't go to school for filmmaking. I'm trying it out. I'm giving an honest, intentional approach to it. Build the plane as you fly it. You would be surprised what you might learn along the way, and have a parachute along the way. Jump in, open-hearted, take the chance.
Wonderful. That's fantastic. I want to mention again, the name of the book is Ghetto Claustrophobia, Dreamin' of Mama While Trying to Speak Woman in Woke Tongues. I've been speaking with the author, Shanta Lee Gander. Thank you so much.
Thank you. This has been a pleasure talking to you.
From the Media Factory in the south end of Burlington, Vermont, this is 99.3 FM, WBTV LP Burlington, streaming online at 99.3wbtv.org. This is Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers. That was an interview with Shanta Lee Gander. You can learn more about her work at shantaleegander.com. And this week's Write the Book prompt was generously suggested by my guest, Shanta Lee Gander, who mentioned her own version of this during our conversation. Here's what she sent me. What are your impossible things that are all true? This is the shenanigans list. Alice laughed. There's no use trying, she said. One can't believe impossible things. I dare say you haven't had much practice, said the Queen. When I was your age, I always did it for half an hour a day. Why, sometimes I've believed as many as six impossible things before breakfast. There goes the shawl again. Are there funny things that people in your life have shared or things that they say? For Shanta, the shenanigans list includes real vignettes and quotes of the ridiculous, the absurd, and the most surreal things that usually has one thinking, this is so good I can't make this up. For this prompt, and perhaps as an ongoing practice, think about quotes, funny things, and the quirky things, and start your list of the impossible, the bizarre, and surreal. Start your own shenanigans list, and you'd be surprised at what material it may provide in the future for other writing. Good luck with your work in the coming week, and tune in next week for another prompt or suggestion. I would love your feedback about the show. Let me know if you'd like me to interview certain authors, if you have events to announce. Be sure to tell your friends about Write the Book and about the podcast site, which is writethebook.podbean.com. And that's where you can get all the archived episodes. New and recent episodes of Write the Book are also available wherever you get your podcasts, so you can just subscribe to have them sent to your podcast app. A reminder to listeners who write, I do share a writing prompt each week, so be sure to check the archives of Write the Book if you'd like to find any that you might have missed. You can also access the podcast and link to our social media presence at my own website, which is shelaughswithoutus.com. If you like the show, please rate it where you find it and talk about it with people who might enjoy it. Up next at 5, stay tuned for Feminist Frenzy, the radio show with a feminist agenda. I'm Shayla Connor Shapiro, and you've been listening to Write the Book. This is 99.3 FM, WBTV LP, Burlington, Vermont, streaming online at 99.3wbtv.org. Stay well and have a great week.